This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The House with a Clock in Its Walls by John Bellairs, narrated by George Guidel. This book, copyrighted 1973 by John Bellairs, is recorded by arrangement with Richard Curtis Incorporated. This performance is copyrighted 1991 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Young Louis Barnevelt is about to have a wonderful adventure, but he doesn't know it yet. He's still a little scared, moving to a new town, a new school, moving in with his eccentric Uncle Jonathan. And now, The House with a Clock in Its Walls.
Chapter 1. Louis Barnevelt fidgeted and wiped his sweaty palms on the seat of the bus that was roaring toward New Zebedee. The year was 1948, and it was a warm, windy summer evening. Outside, that is. Louis could see the moonlit trees tossing gently beyond his window, which was sealed shut, like all the windows on the bus. He looked down at his purple corduroy trousers, the kind that go whip, whip when you walk. He put his hand up and rubbed it across his hair, which was parted in the middle and slicked down with wildroot cream oil. His hand was greasy now, so he wiped it on the seat again. His lips were moving, and he was saying a prayer. It was one of his altar boy prayers. Quia tu es Deus fortitudo mea, quare me repulisti, et quare tristis incedo, dum affligit me inimicus. For thou, O God, art my strength. Why have you cast me off? And why do I go sorrowful while the enemy afflicts me? He tried to remember more prayers, but the only one he could come up with was another question. Quare tristis es anima mea, et quare conturbas me? Why art thou sorrowful, O my soul, and why do you trouble me? It seemed to Louis that all he could think of these days were questions. Where am I going? Who will I meet? Will I like them? What will happen to me? Louis Barnevelt was 10 years old. Until recently he had lived with his parents in a small town near Milwaukee. But his father and mother had been killed suddenly one night in an auto accident. And now Louis was on his way to New Zebedee, the county seat of Capernaum County in the state of Michigan. He was going to live with his Uncle Jonathan, whom he had never met in his life. Of course, Louis had heard a few things about Uncle Jonathan, like that he smoked and drank and played poker. These were not such bad things in a Catholic family, but Louis had two maiden aunts who were Baptists, and they had warned him about Jonathan. He hoped that the warnings would turn out to be unnecessary. As the bus rounded a curve, Louis looked at his reflection in the window next to his seat. He saw a moony, fat face with shiny cheeks. The lips on the face were moving. Louis was saying the altar boy prayers again, this time with the wish that they might make Uncle Jonathan like him. Judica me Deus, judge me, O God. No, don't judge me. Help me to live a happy life. It was 9:05 when the bus pulled up in front of Hemsoth's Rexall drugstore in the town of New Zebedee. Louis got up, wiped his hands on his trousers, and tugged at the enormous cardboard suitcase that hung out over the edge of the metal rack. Louis's father had bought the suitcase in London at the end of World War II. It was covered with ripped and faded Cunard line stickers. Louis pulled hard, and the suitcase lurched down onto his head. He staggered back across the aisle with the suitcase held perilously in the air. Then he sat down suddenly, and the suitcase landed in his lap with a whump. "Oh, come on, don't kill yourself before I have a chance to meet you." There in the aisle stood a man with a bushy red beard that was streaked in several places with white. His Big Mac khaki trousers were bulged out in front by his pot belly, and he was wearing a gold-buttoned red vest over a blue work shirt. Lewis noticed that the vest had four pockets. There were pipe cleaners sticking out of the top two, and a chain of paper clips was strung between the lower pair. One end of the chain was hooked to the winding knob of a gold watch. Jonathan Van Olden Barnevelt took his steaming pipe out of his mouth and held out his hand.
"Hi, Lewis. I'm your Uncle Jonathan. I recognized you from a picture your father once sent me. Welcome to New Zebedee."
Lewis shook hands and noticed that the back of Jonathan's hand was covered with a springy mat of red hair. The coat of hair ran right up his sleeve and disappeared. Lewis wondered if he had red hair all over his body. Jonathan hefted the suitcase and started down the steps of the bus.
"Good Lord, what a monster! It ought to have wheels on the bottom. Ugh. Did you pack some of the bricks from your house?"
Lewis looked so sad at the mention of his house that Jonathan decided to change the subject. He cleared his throat and said,
"Well now, as I was saying, welcome to Capernaum County and beautiful, historic New Zebedee. Population 6,000, not counting—"
A bell overhead began to strike the hour. Jonathan stopped talking. He froze on the spot. He dropped the suitcase, and his arms hung limp at his sides. Lewis, frightened, looked up at him. Jonathan's eyes were glazed. The bell continued to toll. Lewis looked up. The sound was coming from a tall brick steeple across the street. The arches of the belfry made a howling mouth and two gaping eyes. Below the mouth was a large, glowing clock face with iron numerals.
Clang!
Another stroke. It was a deep-throated iron bell, and its sound made Lewis feel hopeless and helpless. Bells like that always did. But what was wrong with Uncle Jonathan? The tolling stopped. Jonathan broke out of his trance. He shook his head convulsively and with a jerky motion raised his hand to his face. He was sweating profusely now. He mopped his forehead and his streaming cheeks.
Oh, sorry, Lewis. I just remembered that I had left a kettle boiling on the stove. I always phase out like that when I remember something I've forgotten, or vice versa. Bottom of the pot's probably ruined by now. Come on, let's get moving."
Lewis looked hard at his uncle, but he said nothing. Together the two of them started to walk. They left the brightly lit main street, and before long they were trotting briskly down a long, tree-lined avenue called Mansion Street. The overhanging boughs made Mansion Street into a long, rustling tunnel. Pools of lamplight stretched off into the distance. As they walked, Jonathan asked Lewis how his schoolwork was coming and whether he knew what George Kell's batting average was this year. He told him that he would have to become a Tiger fan now that he lived in Michigan. Jonathan didn't complain any more about the suitcase, but he did stop frequently to set it down and flex his reddened hand. It seemed to Lewis that Jonathan talked more loudly in the darkness between the streetlights, though why he did this Lewis couldn't say. grown-ups were not supposed to be afraid of the dark. And anyway, this was not a dark, lonely street. There were lights on in most of the houses, and Lewis could hear people laughing and talking and slamming doors. His uncle was certainly a strange person. But he was strange in a likable way. At the corner of Mansion and High, Jonathan stopped. He set down the suitcase in front of a mailbox that said, "For deposit of mail only."
"I live at the top of the hill," said Jonathan, pointing up.
High Street was well named. Up they went, leaning forward and plodding slowly. Lewis asked Jonathan several times if he could carry the suitcase, but each time Jonathan said, "No, thanks, he could manage it." Lewis began to be sorry that he had packed all those books and lead soldiers. When they got to the top of the hill, Jonathan set down the suitcase. He took out a red bandana handkerchief and mopped his face with it.
"Well, there it is, Lewis. Barnabelt's Folly. What do you think of it?"
Lewis looked. He saw a three-story stone mansion with a tall turret on the front. The whole house was lit up, downstairs, upstairs, and upper upstairs. There was even a light in the little oval window that was set like an eye in the bank of shingles at the top of the turret. In the front yard grew a large chestnut tree. Its leaves rustled in the warm summer breeze. Jonathan was standing at parade rest, his hands behind him, his legs wide apart. Again he said,
"What do you think of it, Lewis? Huh?"
"I love it, Uncle Jonathan. I've always wanted to live in a mansion, and this is sure some mansion." Lewis walked up to the frilly fence and touched one of the iron pompons that ran in a row along the top. He stared at the sign that spelled out 100 in red glass reflectors. "Is it real, Uncle Jonathan? The house, I mean." Jonathan glanced at him strangely.
"Yes. Yes. Yes, of course it is. It's real. Let's go inside."
Jonathan lifted the loop of shoestring that held the gate shut. The gate squeaked open, and Lewis started up the walk. Jonathan followed close behind, lugging the suitcase. Up the front steps they went. The front hall was dark, but there was a light at the far end of it. Jonathan set down the suitcase and put his arm around Lewis.
"Come on, let's go in. Don't be bashful. It's your house now."
Lewis walked down the long hall. It seemed to take forever. At the other end he emerged into a room full of yellow light. There were pictures in heavy gilt frames on the walls. There was a mantelpiece covered with a wild assortment of junk. There was a big round table in the middle of the room, and over in the corner was a gray-haired woman in a baggy purple dress. She was standing with her ear to the wall, listening. Lewis stopped and stared. He felt embarrassed. It was as if he had walked in on someone who was doing something he shouldn't be doing. He thought that he and Jonathan had made a good deal of noise coming in, but it was very apparent that the lady, whoever she was, had been surprised when he entered the room, surprised and embarrassed, like himself. Now she straightened up, smoothed her dress, and said cheerfully, "Hi there, I'm Mrs. Zimmerman. I live next door." Lewis found himself staring into one of the wrinkliest faces he had ever seen. But the eyes were friendly, and all the wrinkles were drawn up into smile lines. He shook hands.
"This is Lewis, Florence," said Jonathan. "You remember Charlie writing about him? The bus was on time for a change. They must have gotten the driver drunk. Hey, have you been stealing any of my coins?"
Jonathan walked over to the table. Now Lewis noticed that the red checkered tablecloth was covered with heaps and stacks of coins. All kinds of coins, most of them foreign. Donut-shaped Arabian coins with Boy Scout knots all over them. A heap of dark brown copper coins, all of which were stamped with a picture of a bald man who wore a handlebar mustache. There were big, heavy English pennies that showed Queen Victoria in various states of chininess, and there were tiny silver coins no thicker than your fingernail. There was an egg-shaped Mexican silver dollar and a genuine Roman coin covered with green rust. But most of all, in shiny golden stacks, were brass coins with "Bon pour un franc" printed on them. Louis liked the phrase, and since he didn't know any French, it got twisted around in his mind till it came out "Bon sour 1 franc." "No, I have not been stealing any of your precious brasher doubloons," said Mrs. Zimmerman in an irritated voice. "I was just straightening up the stacks. Okay, brush mush?"
"Straightening up the stacks. I've heard that one before, hag face. But it doesn't matter, because we're going to have to divvy up the coins three ways. You play poker, don't you, Louis?"
"Yes, but my dad won't..." He stopped. Jonathan saw tears in his eyes. Louis choked down a sob and went on. My dad wouldn't have let me play for money."
"Oh, we don't play for money," said Mrs. Zimmerman, laughing. "If we did, this house and everything in it would belong to me." "Poop it would," said Jonathan, shuffling the cards and puffing clouds of smoke from his pipe. "Poop it would. Get 'em all divided up, frumpy." "No? Well, when you're ready, it's going to be dealer's choice, and I'm the first dealer. No ladies' games, like spit out the window or Johnny's nightshirt. Straight 5-card draw. Nothing wild."
He puffed some more, and was about to deal the first hand when he stopped and looked at Mrs. Zimmerman with a mischievous smile.
"Oh, by the way," he said, "you might bring Louis a glass of iced tea and get me a refill. No sugar. And bring out another plate of chocolate chip cookies."
Mrs. Zimmerman stood up and clasped her hands subserviently in front of her. "How would you like your cookies, sir? Stuffed down your throat one by one, or crumbled up and sifted into your shirt collar?" Jonathan stuck out his tongue at her.
"Ignore her, Louis. She thinks she's smart because she's got more college degrees than I have."
"I would be smarter than you in any case, weird beard. Excuse me, folks. I'll be back in a minute." She turned and walked to the kitchen. Jonathan dealt a practice hand while she was gone. When Louis picked his cards up, he noticed that they were old and worn. Most of the corners were missing. But on each faded blue back was a round golden seal with an Aladdin's lamp in the middle. Above and below the seal were the words, "Capernaum County, Magicians Society." Mrs. Zimmerman returned with the cookies and iced tea, and the game began in earnest. Jonathan gathered up the cards and cut them together with a very professional zzzit. He shuffled and started to deal. Louis sipped his iced tea and felt very comfortable, very at home. They played until midnight, by which time Louis had red and black spots in front of his eyes. Pipe smoke hung in layers over the table and rose in a column from the shade of the floor lamp. It made the lamp seem magic, like the one on the playing cards. And there was something else magic about the game. Louis won. He won a lot. Usually he had rotten luck, but in this game he got straight flushes, royal flushes, 4 of a kind. Not all of the time, but enough to keep winning steadily. Maybe it was because Jonathan was such a lousy poker player. What Mrs. Zimmerman had said was certainly true. Whenever Jonathan had a good hand, he snorted and chortled and blew smoke out of both corners of his mouth. When he had a bad hand, He sulked and chewed his pipe stem impatiently. Mrs. Zimmerman was a crafty player who could bluff you under the table with a pair of deuces, but that night she just wasn't getting the cards. Maybe that's why Lewis was winning. Maybe. But he had his doubts. For one thing, he could have sworn that once or twice, when he was reaching out to turn over a card that had been dealt to him, the card had changed. It had changed, just like that, while he was picking it up. This never happened when Lewis was dealing, but it did happen when Jonathan or Mrs. Zimmerman was dealing. And more than once he had been about to throw in a hand when, after a second look, he discovered that the hand was a good one. It was odd. The mantel clock cleared its throat with a whir and started to chime midnight. Lewis shot a quick glance at Uncle Jonathan, who was sitting there, perfectly composed, puffing his pipe. Or was he composed? He seemed to be listening for something. The other clocks all over the house joined in. Lewis sat entranced, listening to high-pitched dings, tinny whangs, melodious electric doorbell sounds, cuckoos from cuckoo clocks, and deep, sinister Chinese gongs roaring, "Bwow! Bwow!" These and many other clock sounds echoed through the house. Now and then during this concert, Lewis looked at Jonathan. Jonathan did not look back. He was staring at the wall. And his eyes had that glazed look again. Mrs. Zimmerman sat through the whole thing with her eyes fixed on the tablecloth. The last clock to strike was the grandfather clock in the study. It made a noise like a steamer trunk full of tin plates falling slowly and solemnly down a flight of stairs. When it stopped striking, Jonathan looked up.
Yes. Where were we? Well, Lewis, it's midnight, isn't it? Game's over, time for bed.
Jonathan cleared the table briskly. He gathered up the playing cards, stacked them, and put a rubber band around them. Snap! Then he reached under the table and came up with a red tin candy box with a picture of the New Zebedee County Courthouse on the lid. He scraped the clattering coins into the box, snapped the lid shut, pushed back his chair, rapped out his pipe into a saucer, and folded his hands in his lap.
"Well, and what do you think of 100 High Street, Lewis?"
"I think it's wonderful, Uncle Jonathan. I like the house, and I like the town. And I like you two an awful lot." Lewis wasn't lying. In spite of Jonathan's strange behavior and the eavesdropping habits of Mrs. Zimmerman, he had had a very good time during his first evening in New Zebedee. In fact, for most of the evening, he had had a great deal of trouble keeping himself from jumping up and down in his seat. He had been told that it was a bad thing to do in company. Jonathan took Lewis's suitcase upstairs, and Lewis got his first look at his new room. There was a tall black bed with battlements at the top of the headboard and footboard. In the corner was a black mirror that matched the bed, and near it was a black marble fireplace with a coffin-like black clock on its mantelpiece. Up against one wall was a tall, glazed bookcase full of old books, and on top of the bookcase was a vase with cattails in it. In the middle of the floor was a large hooked rug. The pattern reminded Lewis of a map of the United States, a map of the U.S. done by a crazy person. Many children might have been put off by the dark woodwork of the old room, but Lewis loved it. He imagined that this was the sort of room Sherlock Holmes would have slept in. Lewis got into his pajamas, put on his bathrobe and slippers, and shuffled down the hall to the bathroom. When he got back, he found that Jonathan had just finished building a fire in his fireplace. Jonathan got up and brushed twigs off his vest.
Lewis, there you are. Need anything else?
Gee, no, I guess not, Uncle Jonathan. This is a great room. I've always wanted a room with a fireplace in it. Jonathan smiled. He went over to the bedside table and turned on the reading lamp.
Read as long as you like tonight, Lewis. Remember, school doesn't start for another 3 weeks.
I don't know if I'll read much after all the poker playing, said Lewis, yawning. But thanks anyway. Good night, Uncle Jonathan.
Good night, Lewis.
Jonathan started to close the door, but he stopped.
Oh, by the way, Lewis, I hope all these clocks don't keep you awake. They're kind of noisy, but, well, I like them. Good night.
He closed the door. Lewis stood there, with a puzzled frown on his face. There was something going on in this house that he couldn't quite get hold of. He thought of Jonathan standing paralyzed while the clock in the church steeple tolled. He thought of Mrs. Zimmerman listening at the wall. It was strange. Oh, well, he thought, shrugging his shoulders, people are funny sometimes. Lewis climbed into bed and turned off the light. A few minutes later he turned it back on. He realized that he was still tense, excited, and wide awake. He climbed out of bed and walked over to the shaky-looking bamboo bookcase that stood by the closet door. What a lot of old dusty books! He pulled one out and wiped the dust off with his sleeve. The faded gilt letters on the black buckram spine said, John L. Stoddard's Lectures, Volume 9, Scotland, England, London. Lewis opened the book and flipped through the slick, glossy pages. He held the book up to his nose. It smelled like Old Spice talcum powder. Books that smelled that way were usually fun to read. He threw the book onto his bed and went to his suitcase. After rummaging about for a while, he came up with a long, narrow box of chocolate-covered mints. He loved to eat candy while he read, and lots of his favorite books at home had brown smudges on the corners of the pages. A few minutes later, Lewis was sitting up in bed with his pillows propped behind him. He was reading about how the Scotch nobles had murdered poor Rizzio right in front of Mary, Queen of Scots. Stoddard compared Rizzio to a purple velvet plum spurting plum juice in all directions. The nobles dragged the poor man, kicking and screaming, into the hallway, where they stabbed him some more. 56 times, said Stoddard, though he didn't say who counted the stabs. Lewis flipped the page and bit into a peppermint patty. Now Stoddard was talking about the permanence of bloodstains, and wondering whether or not the stain on the hall floor in Holyrood really was Rizzio's blood or not. Lewis began to yawn. He turned off the light and went to sleep. But he was awakened, quite suddenly, a little while later. He had been dreaming that he was being chased by the Queen of Spades. Now he sat up, wide awake. He was scared, and he didn't know why.
Creak. Creak.
Someone was tiptoeing down the hall. Lewis sat still and listened. Now the sound was outside his door. Now it was going away down the hall.
Creak. Creak. Creak.
Lewis slid out of bed. As slowly and carefully as he could, he tiptoed to the door. He opened it just as slowly and carefully. He didn't open it far, just a crack. He looked out. The hall was dark, except for a glimmering gray window down at the far end. But Lewis could hear someone moving. And now he saw the faint, pale circle of a flashlight beam moving over the wallpaper. Frightened, Lewis pulled the door shut and then opened it just a crack. the flashlight beam had stopped. Now the figure with the flashlight brought his fist down on the wall, hard. Lewis heard little clots of plaster falling down into the space between the walls. The figure pounded again and again. Lewis stared and opened the door wider. Now the shadowy intruder stepped back, and Lewis saw a bulky shadow against the hall window. A bulky, bearded shadow with a pipe in its mouth. Jonathan. Lewis closed the door as softly as he could and leaned against it, shaking. He hoped Jonathan hadn't seen him. A horrible thought came into his mind. Was Jonathan crazy? Lewis went to the wing chair by the fire and sat down. He watched the black honeycombs as they crumbled into deep red wells. What if Jonathan were crazy? His parents had always warned him against crazy people, the type that lured you into their cars and offered you candy with glue in it. Or was it glue? He couldn't remember. But Jonathan didn't really seem like that kind of person. Or the kind that sneaked into your room at night and stabbed you to death. Lewis sighed. He would just have to wait and see what happened. He went back to bed and had a dream in which he and Jonathan were running round and round the block that had the church on it, the church with the monster-faced steeple. All the houses on the block were lit up, but they couldn't go into any of them to hide. Something tall and dark and shapeless was following them. Finally, they stopped in front of the church, and the tower began to sway as if it were made of rubber. The howling face got closer and closer, and then the dream changed. Lewis was sitting in a room full of glittering coins. He let them run clinking through his fingers until morning came. Chapter 2. Lewis woke up the next day with confused memories of the previous night running around in his head. In general, his impression was a happy one, despite the dark things that lurked in the corners of the picture. He got dressed, went downstairs, and found Jonathan and Mrs. Zimmerman at breakfast. It seemed that Mrs. Zimmerman always came over to cook Jonathan's breakfast, because Jonathan was such a terrible cook. Well, that was fine with Lewis. He sat down to pancakes and sausages, and before long he was figuring out how best to use the 3 weeks of freedom that were left before school began. Lewis soon found out that 3 weeks was not nearly enough time for exploring the town of New Zebedee and the house at 100 High Street. In 3 weeks, he barely got started. To begin with, the town was marvelous. It was the sort of place he had always wanted to live in. Lewis's old hometown in Wisconsin looked as if it had been built yesterday. All the houses were the same size, and the main street was just a row of bars and gas stations. New Zebedee was different. It was full of tall, elaborately decorated old houses. Even the ordinary white frame houses had things that made them seem different. A stained glass window, or a bouquet of iron flowers on top of a cupola. And so many of the houses seemed to be hiding secrets. Jonathan took Lewis for some walks around the town, but more often he just let Lewis find out things for himself. Sometimes Lewis just walked up and down Main Street and stared at the high, elaborate, false fronts of the stores. One of the stores had an abandoned opera house in its upper stories. Jonathan said that the old scenery was still up there, leaning against cases of Mounds bars and 5-cent writing tablets. At one end of Main Street was the Civil War Monument, a fantastic stone object shaped like an artist's easel. Each of the joints and corners of the easel had a soldier or sailor standing on it, threatening the rebel army with a musket or a sword or a cannon swabber or a harpoon. The flat part of the easel was covered with the names of Capernaum County residents who had died in the Civil War. There was a small stone arch near the monument, and it was called the Civil War Monument Annex, because it contained the names that the carvers hadn't been able to get on the big monument. Jonathan's grandfather had fought in the war with the 5th Michigan Fire Zouave Lancers, and Jonathan was full of stories about the old man's exploits. As for the house at 100 High Street, it was every bit as wonderful as the town, besides being strange and more than a little bit scary. There were lots of rooms to explore, third-best upstairs front parlors and second-best back bedrooms, linen closets and playrooms, and just plain rooms. Some of these were empty and full of dust, but there were others that were crammed with antique furniture. There were marble-topped tables galore, and upholstered chairs on squeaky casters, and doilies pinned to the backs of the chairs, and stuffed partridges under glass bell jars. Each room had its own fireplace made of marble that looked, depending on the room, like blue cheese or fudge ripple ice cream, or green hand soap, or milk chocolate. One afternoon, Lewis was walking down the back staircase in the south wing of the mansion when he came to a stained glass window on a landing. There were quite a few stained glass windows in the house. Lewis found them on back staircases like this one, or in unused bathrooms, or at the ends of hallways. Sometimes he even found them set in the ceiling. He had seen this one before, or rather, he had seen another window where this one was now. That was why he stopped and stared. He remembered the other window very well. It had been a big oval window that showed a red tomato sun setting into a blue sea the color of old medicine bottles. The oval frame was still there, but in it, Lewis found a window that showed a man fleeing from a forest. The forest was plum-colored, and the grass under the man's feet was bright green. The sky in the picture was a squirming, oily, brownish red. It reminded Lewis of furniture polish. What had happened to the other window? Did Jonathan go around changing them during the night? It was pretty strange. Another thing that was strange was the coat rack in the front hall. At first, Lewis had thought that it was just an ordinary coat rack. It stood about 6 feet high, and it had a little round mirror on the front. There were pegs for coats and hats, and there was a little wooden compartment in the front for rubbers. It looked very ordinary. But one day, when Lewis was hanging up his raincoat, he looked at the mirror and saw a Mayan step pyramid in a steaming green jungle. He knew that the pyramid was Mayan because he had a picture of it among his Viewmaster slides. Only this scene was not fake three-dimensional the way the slides were. It looked as if you could reach through the mirror and touch the vines. As Lewis watched, a brilliant red bird with a long tail flew from one tree to another. Waves of heat made the pyramid ripple. Lewis blinked and stared again. He was looking at the reflection of the rainy gray window behind him. Lewis thought a lot about the stained glass windows and the coat rack. Were they magic? He believed in magic, even though he had been taught not to. His father had spent one whole afternoon explaining to Lewis that ghosts were caused by X-rays bouncing off distant planets. But Lewis was a stubborn boy. And besides, hadn't he seen the Aladdin's lamp on the back of Jonathan's playing cards? And the words, Capernaum County Magicians Society? He was convinced that magic was at the bottom of this mystery. Lewis was also convinced that he would have to solve another mystery before he could tackle the problem of the coat rack and the stained glass windows. He would have to find out why Jonathan prowled the house every night with a flashlight in his hand. Lewis had discovered that the strange incident on his first night in New Zebedee was part of a regular pattern. Every night after 12, Jonathan was out there searching. What he was searching for, Lewis couldn't say. Again and again, as on that first night, he had heard the floorboards creak outside his door. Again and again, he had heard Jonathan tiptoeing stealthily down the hall, entering rooms, closing doors. He heard him overhead on the third floor, where Jonathan hardly ever went during the day. Then he would be back downstairs, poking around, stumbling into furniture. Maybe he was scared of burglars. Maybe so, but then why did he pound on the wall? Burglars seldom got into walls. Lewis had to find out what was going on, and so, one night, a little after 12, Lewis lowered himself silently from his bed to the cold floorboards. As stealthily as he could, he tiptoed across the room, but the warped boards complained under his feet. By the time he got to the door, he was thoroughly shaken. He wiped his hands on his robe several times and turned the knob. He took a deep breath, let it out, and stepped out into the dark hallway. Lewis clamped his hand over his mouth. He had stepped on the protruding head of a nail. It didn't really hurt much, but Lewis was scared of tetanus. When his panic had died down, he took another step. He began to edge his way down the hall. But Lewis was no better at stealthy creeping than you might think, and by the time he had bumped his head against a heavy gilt picture frame for about the third time, Jonathan called to him from one of the distant rooms.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Lewis, stop playing Sherlock Holmes. You make a better Dr. Watson. Come on and join me. I'm in the bedroom with the green fireplace."
Lewis was glad that his red face didn't shine in the dark. Well, at least Jonathan wasn't mad. Lewis picked his way down the hall until he found an open door. There was Jonathan, standing in the dark with a flashlight in his hand. He was playing the light over the mantel clock, a boxy black affair with gold handles on the sides, like a coffin.
"Evening, Lewis. Or morning, as the case may be. Would you care to join me on my rounds?"
Jonathan's voice sounded tight and nervous. Lewis hesitated a moment, and then he plunged in. "Uncle Jonathan, what are you doing?"
"Stopping the clocks. During the day it's nice to have clocks ticking all over the house, but at night it keeps me awake. You know how it is, Lewis, with faucets and the like."
Still chattering nervously, Jonathan turned the clock around, reached into the back of it, and halted the stubby pendulum. Then he motioned for Lewis to follow him, and, waving the flashlight a little too cheerfully, walked on to the next room. Lewis followed, but he was puzzled. "Uncle Jonathan, why don't you turn the room lights on?" His uncle was silent for a minute. Then he said in that same nervous voice,
"Oh, well, you know how it is, Lewis. If I were to go from one room to another, snapping lights on and off, what would the neighbors think? And what about the electric bill? Do you know that you get billed for an hour's worth of electricity every time you snap the lights on and off?"
This explanation did not sound convincing to Lewis. In the first place, Uncle Jonathan had never before given any sign that he cared what the neighbors thought about anything he did. If he wanted to sit in the glider under the chestnut tree and play a saxophone at 3 a.m., he was likely to do just that. In the second place, Jonathan had more than once left the floor lamp in his study burning all night. He was a careless man, and not the sort who worried about big electric bills. It was true that Lewis had only known his uncle for 3 weeks, but he felt that he already had a pretty good idea of what Jonathan was like. On the other hand, he couldn't very well say, "Uncle Jonathan, you're lying through your teeth." So, he silently followed his uncle to the next room, the second-best upstairs bathroom. It had a fireplace, too, a white tile one, and there was a small white plastic clock buzzing on the mantel. Jonathan unplugged it without saying anything and went on to the next room, where he stopped a cherry wood clock with a pendulum that used 3 columns of mercury as a weight, and then on to the next room. The last clock to be silenced was the grandfather clock in the study. Jonathan's study had a very high ceiling, and all the walls were lined with books. There was a fat, slouchy, brown leather easy chair that hissed when you sat down in it, and, of course, there was a fireplace, and there was still a fire burning in it. Over in a corner by the sliding doors that opened into the dining room stood the tall, gloomy clock. The brass disc on the pendulum flashed dimly in the light of the dying fire. Jonathan reached inside and grabbed the long black rod. The clock stopped. Now that their strange tour was over, Jonathan lapsed into silence. He seemed to be thinking. He walked over to the fireplace, stirred up the fire, and put on another log. He threw himself down into the leather chair and waved his arm at the green easy chair on the other side of the fireplace. "Have a seat, Lewis. I'd like to have a talk with you." Lewis wondered if he was going to get bawled out for sneaking up on his uncle. It didn't seem likely. Jonathan looked and sounded friendly, though his voice was still a little edgy. Lewis sat down and watched as Jonathan lit up his hookah. Lewis always liked to watch him do this. The hookah was shaped like a Spanish galleon, and the crow's nest on the mainmast was the bowl. The body of the ship was full of water for cooling the smoke, and up on the bow stood the tiny ceramic figure of a bosun with his pipe to his lips. A long hose was plugged into the ship's stern, and there was a black rubber mouthpiece on the end. When you blew into the hose, the burning tobacco in the crow's nest sent up a long column of smoke, and the bosun went whee on his little pipe. Sometimes, when Jonathan made a mistake and filled the boat too full of water, the bosun went boop and blew bubbles. When Jonathan had the pipe going good, he drew in a big mouthful of smoke, let it out slowly, and said, "Lewis, I think it would be better for you to be scared than it would be for you to think of your uncle as a crabby old lunatic." "I don't think you're crabby," said Lewis. Jonathan laughed. "But you do think I'm off my rocker. Well, after tonight I wouldn't blame you." Lewis blushed. "No, Uncle Jonathan, I never meant that. You know, I don't think—" Jonathan smiled. "Yes, of course I know. But all the same, I think it would be better if you knew something about this clock business. I can't tell you all about it, because I don't know all about it. In fact, there are times when I think I don't know much about it at all. But I'll tell you what I know." He crossed his legs, sat back, and puffed some more at his pipe. Lewis sat forward in the big green chair. He kept clasping and unclasping his hands, and he stared hard at Jonathan. After a brief dramatic pause and a particularly long drag at the galleon hookah, Jonathan began. "I haven't lived in this house always, Lewis. In fact, I only moved here 5 years ago. I used to live down on Spruce Street, near the waterworks. But when the old owner died and the place was put up for sale cheap, and it meant a chance to live next door to my best friend, Mrs. Zimmerman—"
"Who was the old owner?"
asked Lewis, interrupting. I was going to get around to that. His name was Isaac Izzard. Initials II, like a Roman numeral II.
You'll find his double I carved or painted or stamped on all sorts of things all over this house. The wainscoting, the floorboards, the insides of cupboards, the fuse box, the mantelpieces everywhere. You'll even find a Roman numeral II worked into the tracery on the wallpaper in the upstairs front hallway.
Jonathan paused for a second and looked thoughtful.
Have to get that paper replaced some day. Oh, well, back to what I was saying. Old Isaac Izzard. His name is odd, isn't it? Mrs. Zimmerman thinks that it comes from Izzard, which in some parts of England is the word for Zed, which is the word the English use to identify the letter Z. I go along with Mrs. Zimmerman's theory because I can't think of a better one. And besides, she is a Z-lady, so she should know. But, as I was saying, and I will get around to saying something sometime, Lewis.
He puffed on his pipe some more and wriggled around in the chair to get comfortable.
As I was saying, old Isaac was a warlock.
What's that? Uncle Jonathan looked very serious.
It's the word for a male witch.
Lewis shuddered. Then, out of nowhere, a strange thought came to him. "Are you one, too?" he asked in a tiny, frightened voice. Jonathan looked at him with a strange smile.
"Would it scare you if I said I was?"
"No. I like you an awful lot, and you can be a warlock if you want to be one, I guess. You wouldn't be a bad one, I know."
"That depends on how you mean bad," said Jonathan, chuckling. "If you mean that I wouldn't be an evil one, you're right. If you mean that I wouldn't be too bad at wizarding, well, I don't know. I'm pretty much of a parlor magician, though I have a few tricks that go beyond rabbits and playing cards."
"Like stained glass windows and coat racks?" said Lewis, grinning.
"Yes, exactly like those. And just to make you perfectly secure, let me inform you that Mrs. Zimmerman is also a wizard, though in her case the term should be witch."
"Couldn't you find a better name?" asked Lewis timidly.
"Well, she prefers maga or enchantrix, but I can't use such words without breaking up, so she's old Witch Florence to me. She's really a much more serious wizard than I am. Got her D-Mag-A, that's Doctor Magicorum Artium, from the University of Göttingen in Germany in 1922. I just have an A-B from Michigan Agricultural College."
"What in?" asked Lewis, as if he were interviewing Jonathan for a job. Actually, he was interested in Jonathan's college work. Both of Lewis's parents had gone to college, and they always talked a lot about their college work.
"What in?" said Jonathan, blushing. "What in? Why, agricultural science, animal husbandry and all that. I was going to be a farmer till my grandpa died and left me a pile of money. But back to Isaac Izzard. You're still interested, aren't you?"
"Oh, yes, of course. Please tell me, I want to know."
"Isaac, as I say, was a wizard. He fooled around with black magic, the worst kind of thing a wizard can do. I can't tell you about anything bad that I absolutely know he did, for sure, but if one wizard can judge another, I'd say he was an evil one, a very evil one. Mrs. Zimmerman thinks so, too. She lived next door to him for years, remember? You'll have to ask her about him yourself, of course, but there were many evenings when she and I would stand in her backyard and look up and see old Isaac's evil face in the window of the cupola on top of the house. He'd be holding an oil lamp and just staring out at the night. Mrs. Zimmerman claims that he would sit for hours in the cupola during the day. He seemed to be taking notes."
"Gee, that is weird. What was he taking notes for?"
"Lord only knows, Lewis. But I'm sure it wasn't anything good. At any rate, to get on with my story,
It must be getting pretty late by now, but without the clocks I have no idea what time it is. Where was I? Oh, yes. Old Isaac died during a wild thunderstorm. One of the worst in the history of Capernaum County. You can look it up in the New Zebedee Chronicle if you want to. Roofs blown off barns, trees uprooted, and a bolt of lightning melted the iron doors on the tomb Isaac is buried in now. I'll have to show you that tomb some day. Ugly old dump. One of those little stone houses for the respectable dead. There are several of them up in our cemetery, some of them really fancy. This one was built by Isaac's family in the 1850s, but it was never used till they put his wife in there. She died before he did. What was she like? Pretty strange, as you'd have to be, to choose Isaac Izzard for a husband. I don't remember anything about her but her eyeglasses. Lewis stared.
Her eyeglasses?
Yes. I passed her once on the street, and she turned and looked at me. It might have been the way the sun caught her spectacles, but I remember two freezing circles of gray light burning into me. I turned away and closed my eyes, but those two cold spots stayed there. I had nightmares for a week after that.
How did she die? Lewis imagined Mrs. Izzard falling from a cliff during a hurricane, or flinging herself from the cupola of the house.
How? Quietly and mysteriously. No funeral. Some strange-looking people from out of town came and helped Isaac bury her. After that he went into seclusion. Further seclusion, that is. He and she had always been hermits, but after her death he really shut himself up. Built a big, high, board fence between this house and Mrs. Zimmerman's. I had it torn down as soon as I moved in. He smiled contentedly.
Lewis felt that his Uncle Jonathan was happy living at 100 High Street, despite the fact that old Isaac Izzard had made the place his castle.
"Is that all there is to the story?" asked Lewis cautiously.
"Oh, my, no, we're just getting to the good part. Look, here I am selfishly puffing away at this boat, and you have nothing. Let's go out to the kitchen and get a couple of glasses of milk and some chocolate chip cookies, okay?"
"Sure," said Lewis, who liked chocolate chip cookies even more than he liked Welch's fudge bars. In a few minutes they were back in the study, sitting by the quietly crackling fire and munching cookies. Suddenly a book fell out of the bookcase. Flop! Two more fell out. Flop, flop. Lewis stared at the black gap in the row of books. A long, withered, bony hand appeared. It seemed to be groping for something. Lewis sat rigid with terror, but Jonathan merely smiled.
"A little to your left, my dear. That's it. Now you've got it."
A latch clicked, and a large section of the built-in bookcase swung outwards. More books fell to the floor. And there stood Mrs. Zimmerman, with a strand of cobweb hanging from her left eyeglass. Her sleeve was covered with whitish dust. "Fine way to build a secret panel," she grumbled, "with the latch on the room side instead of on the passage side."
"It adds to the mystery, dollface. As you might have guessed, Lewis, this house has a secret passageway. You enter it through the china cupboard in the kitchen. Come on in, Florence. I was just going to tell Lewis about the clock in the walls."
Mrs. Zimmerman gave him a look as if to say, "Do you think that's a wise thing to do?" But she shrugged and helped herself to the cookies and milk. "Good cookies," she said, munching. "Very good."
"She always says that because she makes them," explained Jonathan, helping himself to two more. "And now that everyone's mouth is stuffed, including mine, I guess I'll go on. Where were we? Oh, yes, well, I had no sooner moved in here than I felt that something was wrong. The house had a kind of listening stillness. And then I heard it."
"Heard what?" This was Lewis, who had worked himself to the edge of his chair. He had even stopped eating his cookie.
"The clock. You know how you can be in a room with a clock ticking, and you won't notice it for a long time. Then, when things are very, very quiet, and you aren't thinking about anything in particular, there it is."
Lewis jumped up and looked around wildly. "Where?"
Jonathan laughed. "No, no, no, I didn't mean to frighten you like that. I mean, I..."